Chapter 22. Her Satanic Majesty. Even as he masterminded the land campaigns, Grant investigated ways to shut down the few remaining southern ports that defied the Union blockade. A major objective was to capture the port of Wilmington, North Carolina, a move Gideon Welles thought might damage the Confederacy almost as much as losing Richmond. The last major harbor east of the Mississippi River, still available to blockade runners, it provided ammunition and other essential imports that went straight to bolster Lee's army. Grant cited a compelling diplomatic need to seize Wilmington, because foreign governments, particularly the British government, were constantly threatening that unless ours could maintain the blockade of that coast, they should cease to recognize any blockade. The key obstacle to any operation against Wilmington was Fort Fisher, a mammoth earthwork redoubt guarding the mouth of the Cape Fear River just below the port. When Grant discovered that Confederate soldiers in North Carolina were being shunted off to fight Sherman in Georgia, he spotted a chance to deprive the Confederacy of its last Atlantic outpost. By early December, Ben Butler had concocted a far-fetched scheme for taking Fort Fisher by loading an old vessel with 215 tons of gunpowder, towing it near the fort, then igniting it. Grant was dubious. Whether the report will be sufficient even to wake up the garrison in the fort, if they happen to be asleep at the time of the explosion, I do not know. It is at least foolish to think that the effect of the explosion could be transmitted to such a distance with enough force to weaken the fort. Lincoln acquiesced to the plan without placing much credence in it, saying mockingly, "We might as well explode the notion with powder as with anything else." Grant couldn't banish Butler from the expedition, which would occur under the aegis of his Department of Virginia and North Carolina. Rear Admiral David D. Porter gathered an enormous fleet of 60 ships, while Butler readied 6,500 men to sail to Fort Fisher under General Godfrey Weitzel. Grant's confidence in Butler was minimal, and he hoped that 29-year-old Weitzel would perform the actual fighting. But the headstrong Butler insisted on going along and taking personal control, which boded ill for the venture. Meanwhile, weather-related delays enabled the rebel garrison to replenish its numbers. The day before Christmas, the USS Louisiana, bulging with gunpowder, drifted close to Fort Fisher, but true to Grant's prediction, the explosion inflicted little harm, leading to much merriment at Butler's expense. Most of the blast's explosive shock dissipated in the air. When Porter unleashed a furious cannonade at the fort, many shells landed with a harmless thud in surrounding soil. On Christmas morning, he sprayed the fort with 10,000 rounds of shot and shell, which was supposed to be followed by a spirited infantry assault from the fort's land side. Unfortunately, Butler, observing Confederate artillery on the parapet, got cold feet and called off the mission. An irate Porter blasted Butler for not attempting to take possession of the forts, which were so blown up, burst up, and torn up that the people inside had no intention of fighting anymore. It could have been taken on Christmas with 500 men, without losing a soldier. Porter may have overstated his case. While he had ravaged the fort's water side, many heavy guns on the land side had survived his onslaught. Joining Porter in blaming Butler, Grant now had sufficient cause to fire him, and demanded his removal as an unsafe commander for a large army. Having won re-election, Lincoln no longer feared political reprisals from Butler, and approved. Butler was replaced at the helm of the Army of the James by a West Point graduate, General Edward O. C. Ord. Butler was not one to leave quietly. As his parting shot, he explained to his soldiers what he discerned as the true reason for his dismissal. "I have refused to order the sacrifice of soldiers and am relieved from your command. The wasted blood of my men does not stain my garments." Ord asked Grant whether he should suppress this inflammatory statement. Perhaps thinking this vengeful farewell would hurt Butler more than help, Grant allowed its release. Butler rushed off to protest to a congressional committee that he had wisely called off the Fort Fisher attack and been victimized for his courage. Well into his post-war career, Butler spewed venom at Grant, telling one friend before Grant became president that he had been the most unpopular soldier in the whole army and was the weakest, feeblest creature that ever was thought of for any public office. Prodded by Lincoln, Grant prepared for a second action against Fort Fisher, where he would enjoy the largest naval force ever assembled, said Wells. Having demonstrated the power of land and sea operations throughout the war, Grant advised General Alfred Terry, a classically educated lawyer, of the paramount need for unity of action with Admiral Porter. On January 6, 1865, the new expedition set sail for Fort Fisher, only this time the seamen and Marines hit the ground running. Following a heavy Navy bombardment, they grabbed the fort and took more than 2,000 prisoners. This dramatic turning point in the war ended the heyday of blockade runners and left Galveston the sole port open to the shrinking Confederacy. Reeling from the Fort Fisher debacle, the Confederate Vice President Alexander Stevens mourned it as one of the greatest disasters that had befallen our cause from the beginning of the war, and Confederate desertions in North Carolina leapt dramatically. Once again, Grant hovered as the tutelary spirit behind a major victory. Grant stands very much higher for the Fort Fisher affair. It showed the stupid world what it had forgotten, that he really controls the armies of the U.S., Badeau told James Wilson. They are just beginning to realize that all these stupendous combinations which have resulted so splendidly are the fruit of one mastermind. Despite the fort's capture, Admiral Porter chose to criticize Grant mercilessly in a letter to Gideon Wells that castigated Grant for allowing Butler to accompany the first expedition. He portrayed Grant as ungrateful for the signal role played by the Navy at Fort Fisher, reviling him as a shallow opportunist, always willing to take the credit when anything is done, and equally ready to lay the blame of the failure on the Navy when a failure takes place. Porter also claimed Grant had always stolen credit from him, and that without his help, Grant never would have been Lieutenant General. When Grant, as president, nominated Porter to be a full admiral, this blistering letter was published, and Julia Grant claimed it hit her unprepared husband hard. General Grant felt dreadfully hurt, as he really thought a great deal of Porter, who vowed he never wrote the letter, but there it was in his own handwriting. Implausibly, Porter pretended to have no recollection of writing the letter, telling Grant he regretted exceedingly the loss of your friendship. By December 1864, Grant had tightened the noose around Richmond, severing its southern rail links and isolating the town. Sheridan was able to transfer his entire corps from the Shenandoah Valley to Petersburg. As it grew clear that final victory glimmered in the distance, and as snow fell thickly and temperatures dipped below zero, summer tents at City Point headquarters gave way to durable log huts. Grant's wooden quarters consisted of an office in the front portion, a private area in the rear. Horace Porter described the atmosphere as neat and Spartan. An iron camp bed, an iron washstand, a couple of pine tables, and a few common wooden chairs constituted the furniture. The floor was entirely bare. In the dank, gloomy days before Christmas, Grant was laid up with a stomach disorder and hemorrhoids, his condition troubling enough that he made the ultimate sacrifice. He briefly renounced cigars. He shouldered so much responsibility that he was upset at being confined to bed and confessed to Julia how much he relied on sheer willpower. I know how much there is dependent on me and will prove myself equal to the task. I believe determination can do a great deal to sustain one, and I have that quality, certainly, to its fullest extent. On Christmas Day, Fred appeared and immediately saddled up for a ride with his father. Julia lingered in Burlington with the other children until January, when she joined her husband at City Point. The Grants were now a celebrated couple with many worldly temptations dangled before them. They were delighted by the gift of a fully equipped house in Philadelphia given to them by several dozen grateful citizens. Neither then nor later was Grant nagged by the possible impropriety of such gifts, regarding them as a reward commonly bestowed upon victorious generals. Indeed, such gifts were then seen not as nefarious, but as generous gestures to patriotic heroes for the sacrifices they had made. Still, such gifts would accumulate in the future and raise uncomfortable questions about Grant's judgment in accepting them. For the most part, Grant had a well-developed ethical sense, as evidenced by his response when offered a free stake in shady oil properties. "I have a perfect abhorrence of having any interest in anything which might prove speculative at the expense of a confiding public," he wrote back. When Julia joined him in January, she domesticated the rough-hewn cabin where her husband lived and worked, much as she had at Hardscrabble, and took her meals on equal terms with his officers. She brightened up the table by draping a makeshift cloth over it and had a way of cheering the men with her vivacity and attending to anyone who was ailing. Having spent much of the war apart from Ulysses, she didn't mind the austere military milieu. "I am snugly nestled away in my husband's log cabin," she confided to a friend, and told of long nocturnal chats with him. "Am I not a happy woman?" It was also clear that she stood guard over her husband's drinking. Right before she arrived at City Point, Henry W. Bellows of the U.S. Sanitary Commission visited Grant and speculated privately that he might have taken just a little too much soup, a wording that suggests he was tipsy. Gideon Wells, that inveterate chronicler of invidious gossip, recorded in his diary on December 29th that Grant had recently sailed back to Virginia from Washington, accompanied by Senator Zachariah Chandler, and the boat's skipper, a Captain Mitchell, had related that both Grant and Chandler were very drunk. Grant got into Mitchell's berth and slept off the fumes. Chandler was continuously and all the time drunk. As always, when Julia was around, rumors of Grant's drinking vanished on the spot. On New Year's Day, 1865, Grant issued orders to observe a day of peace with nearby rebel soldiers and refrain from firing upon them unless fired upon first. For Thanksgiving, donors in New York had shipped 80,000 pounds of turkey for distribution among Union troops, and Lee had allowed them to enjoy it in peace. Now Grant repaid the courtly gesture. "We are never to be outdone," Rawlins wrote proudly, "either in fighting or magnanimity." With 124,000 well-fed soldiers at his disposal, Grant felt hopeful about his prospects against Lee's dwindling force of 57,000 men. Normally not inclined to boast, Grant wrote on January 2nd, "We now have an army of soldiers such as the world never saw before." The high rate of Confederate desertions, entire squads now melted away, strengthened his confidence. Lee's officers would have begged to differ, one affirming that Lee had 60,000 of the best soldiers in the world and they have unbounded confidence in him. We will storm Grant in his breastworks if they were twice as strong. But this was so much whistling in the dark, and some Confederate officers began to voice hitherto taboo feelings. "The wolf is at the door here," said a staff officer in Richmond. "We dread starvation far more than we do Grant or Sherman. Famine, that is the word now." The manifold attacks by Grant against railroads, canals, and ports had impoverished the Confederate supply chain. Lee, fearing his army would fall apart from hunger, railed at the dangerous complacency of Southern politicians. After returning from a visit to Richmond, he strode his room in agitation and vented his spleen to his son. "I have been up to see the Congress, and they do not seem able to do anything except eat peanuts and chew tobacco, while my army is starving. I told them the condition my men were in, and that something must be done at once, but I can't get them to do anything." In early January, Grant was made privy to a plan sanctioned by the president to have Francis P. Blair, Sr., an old Jacksonian Democrat, pass through City Point en route to secret talks with Jefferson Davis. In all likelihood, Grant heard from Blair what was afoot, Blair having come up with a chimerical scheme to reunite North and South by having them engage in a joint operation to eject the French from Mexico. If Lincoln scoffed at the idea, he was curious to see what it might yield. Jefferson Davis, a proud and testy man, assumed Lincoln would stick by his old demand for unconditional surrender. Still, he thought the Southern populace might be reinvigorated by Lincoln's intransigence and peace proponents discredited, and so he authorized Blair to inform Lincoln of his willingness to enter into conference with a view to secure peace to the two countries. Lincoln communicated his readiness to enter into informal talks with the view of securing peace to the people of our one common country. For his negotiating team, Davis chose three prominent figures to proceed to Washington: Vice President Alexander H. Stephens, President Pro Tem of the Senate Robert M. T. Hunter, and Assistant Secretary of War John A. Campbell. All had occupied high positions in the old federal government. All three had also expressed dissatisfaction with Confederate conduct of the war and couldn't be dismissed as mere flunkies or pliant tools of Jefferson Davis. On Sunday, January 29th, the three emissaries crossed the outer perimeter of Petersburg's defenses under a flag of truce. After years of grueling warfare, they were hailed as messengers of peace, and a surprisingly festive mood reigned as their carriage rolled from Confederate to Federal lines, both sides greeting the ambassadors with prolonged and enthusiastic applause and ecstatic cries of "Peace! Peace!" To cheers from their respective armies, the Southern band played Dixie and the Northern band Yankee Doodle, before young men on both sides responded with mutual appreciation to "Home Sweet Home." Because Grant was at Fort Fisher, the three emissaries indicated to a Lieutenant Colonel Hatch that Grant had been forewarned of their journey to Washington as peace commissioners. Hatch contacted Ord, who contacted Stanton, who said to await Lincoln's instructions. In a quandary over what to do, Hatch returned to the three commissioners and blurted out, in what may have been a delaying tactic, that Grant was on a big drunk and it might be some time before there was any reply. The next morning, the three men directed a letter to Grant himself. Back at City Point on January 31st, Grant sent Lincoln a copy of the letter, which expressed the commissioner's wish to confer with him in Washington. Shortly afterward, Grant got a telegram from Stanton alerting him that Major Thomas T. Eckert was on his way to Virginia, bearing presidential instructions. That night, Grant had Colonel Orville Babcock escort the three commissioners to his log cabin, where they found him scribbling at a small table in the glow of a kerosene lamp. When Babcock tapped at the door, Grant called out, "Come in," in a cordial voice that Alexander Stephens said he would never forget. Chatting with the three men, Grant conspicuously avoided any political talk. He treated them in a courteous manner that concealed his deep indignation at what the South had wrought. "For my own part, I never had admitted, and never was ready to admit, that they were representatives of a government," he wrote in his memoirs. There had been too great a waste of blood and treasure to concede anything of the kind. Nevertheless, Grant hospitably installed the three men in well-appointed staterooms on the steamer Mary Martin, where they remained for several days. Grant assigned no guards to watch over them, invited them to dine with his officers, and allowed them to saunter about freely, fostering tremendous goodwill. He bore little resemblance to the fearsome ogre conjured up by the Southern press. Though he established rapport with all three men, Alexander Stephens, a pale, wizened little man with a keen mind and boyish face, was especially enchanted by Grant. "I was instantly struck with the great simplicity and perfect naturalness of his manners, and the entire absence of everything like affectation, show, or even the usual military air of men in his position." The observant Stevens noted Grant's economical speech and the exceptional intelligence that lay behind his taciturn style. "As saw before being with him long, that he was exceedingly quick in perception and direct in purpose, with a vast deal more of brains than tongue, as ready as that was at his command." Despite Grant's circumspection, Stevens discerned that he wished peace talks to occur and was exceedingly anxious for a termination of our war. Stevens decided that Grant was one of the most remarkable men he had ever met and would someday exert a controlling influence in shaping the destinies of this country. The next afternoon, Major Eckert arrived, and Secretary of State Seward made his way separately to Fort Monroe. Eckert was instructed to send the three peace commissioners to meet Seward only if they agreed they had come with the view of securing peace to the people of our one common country. Not surprisingly, the three men winced at this explosive formulation, which violated the two countries position dictated by Jefferson Davis. That night, Eckert wired Lincoln that the three commissioners refused to comply with his terms. When he met Seward the next morning, he informed him the commissioners wouldn't be able to come. Just as it looked as if the peace talks had struck an insurmountable obstacle, Grant did something entirely out of character that bespoke his increased trust and intimacy with the president. He wired Stanton that his talks with Stevens and Hunter persuaded him that their intentions are good and their desire sincere to restore peace and union. I fear now they are going back without any expression from anyone in authority will have a bad influence. Clearly Grant trespassed into the forbidden sphere of public policy, even subtly reproaching Lincoln and Stanton for their intransigence. The supposedly bloodthirsty man of war craved peace. The telegram hit the bullseye, confirming Grant's sound political instincts and new intimacy with Lincoln. About to recall Eckert and Seward, Lincoln not only scratched that notion, but decided on the strength of Grant's message to travel to Fort Monroe to meet with the commissioners, even though he doubted anything productive would ensue. Grant promised Lincoln not to relax military pressure as the talks progressed. By the time Lincoln and Seward met the commissioners on February 3rd aboard the steamer River Queen, anchored at Hampton Roads, the war's calculus had been altered by congressional passage of the 13th Amendment outlawing slavery. On January 31st, the final vote in the House of Representatives was received with tumultuous cheers and applause. Hats were hurled in the air, ladies in the galleries flapped handkerchiefs. At the White House, Lincoln lauded the amendment as a king's cure-all for all evils. To try to kill the vote, amendment opponents had pointed to rumored peace talks, but Lincoln saved the day by stating ambiguously that there were no peace commissioners in the city, Washington, or likely to be in it. True, as far as it went. The stirring Republican victory strengthened the Northern commitment to blotting out slavery and made any backsliding on the issue unthinkable. Lincoln also hoped the vote would alert Southerners that their struggle to save slavery was now doomed. For several hours, Lincoln and Seward parleyed with the commissioners in the River Queen's saloon. As a member of the military, Grant was expressly excluded. There was a determination on the part of Mr. Lincoln and Mr. Stanton to exclude the military authorities altogether from the final settlement, after submission should be secured, wrote Badeau. No notes were taken, no secretaries allowed. Lincoln respected the head of the delegation, Alexander Stevens, having once praised a speech he made against the Mexican War as the very best speech of an hour's length I ever heard. But Lincoln, no pushover, immediately made clear he had three non-negotiable conditions: permanent restoration of the Union, an end to slavery, and no cessation of hostilities until all rebel forces were disbanded. The peace commissioners had expected concessions and were taken aback by these unbending terms. The North was winning the war, and Lincoln knew he played a strong hand. Hunter interjected, "Mr. President, if we understand you correctly, you think that we of the Confederacy have committed treason, that we are traitors to your government, that we have forfeited our rights and are proper subjects for the hangman. Is that not about what your words imply?" Lincoln didn't sugarcoat the truth. "Yes, you have stated the proposition better than I did. That is about the size of it." Nonetheless, at moments, Lincoln sounded more conciliatory, expressing a willingness to compensate Southerners for forfeited slaves. While Seward objected to this, Lincoln persisted. If it was wrong in the South to hold slaves, it was wrong in the North to carry on the slave trade and sell them to the South. Despite such statements, it grew clear that an unbridgeable gulf now yawned between Lincoln and the commissioners, and that the talks had encountered a dead end. When Lincoln gave him a post-mortem on the meeting, Grant was struck by the president's generous and kindly spirit toward the Southern people, and the absence of a revengeful disposition, attitudes to be reflected in Grant's own charitable behavior toward the South. Lincoln delighted Grant with his description of how the shriveled Stevens was bundled up in a gray woolen overcoat several sizes too large. As Lincoln recalled, "The cabin soon began to get pretty warm, and after a while, Stevens stood up and pulled off his big coat. He slipped it off just about as you would husk an ear of corn. I couldn't help thinking as I looked first at the overcoat and then at the man, well, that's the biggest chuck and the smallest nubbin I ever laid eyes on." Grant's bond with Lincoln deepened when he helped to resolve a family dilemma concerning 21-year-old Robert Lincoln, the president's eldest son, who had graduated from Harvard College. Good-looking and genial, Robert had been criticized for evading war service, criticism all the more mortifying since he was eager to serve. Mary Lincoln, having already lost two children, didn't care to risk a third and grew wildly emotional on the subject. Lincoln hesitated to cross her as her mental instability grew more evident. Although he tried to steer Robert to Harvard Law School, the ploy didn't succeed. With relations already awkward and distant with his eldest son, Lincoln hit on an ingenious way to appease both Mary and Robert. On January 19th, he sent Grant a tactful letter that began with a beautiful, if slightly unrealistic, line, "Please read and answer this letter as though I was not president, but only a friend." He then stated his son's wish to see something of the war before it ends, and asked if Robert could join Grant's military family. Lincoln even extended an unusual offer to pay his army expenses. From Annapolis, Grant hastily replied on the blank bottom half of Lincoln's letter, offering Robert an adjutant's job on his staff with the rank of captain. On February 21st, Robert Lincoln reported for duty at Grant's headquarters. Sympathetic to the president's predicament, Grant guarded Robert from perilous situations and often relegated him to meeting visiting dignitaries. With his bright, amiable manner, Robert Lincoln became a popular figure at headquarters, whose presence only made the president more eager to visit City Point, as perhaps Grant had hoped. It is unlikely that Mary Lincoln was ever reconciled to her son's presence in the war, even at such a relatively safe spot. Early 1865 witnessed the slow-motion unraveling of the Army of Northern Virginia, which was gradually thinned out by massive desertions amounting to about a regiment per day. Tattered men in large groups appeared in Grant's camps, surrendering their weapons. "Hundreds of men are deserting nightly," Lee confessed to Jefferson Davis, as such departures shaved off 8% of his army in January, followed by a further 8% in February. Driven by poor food, withheld pay, and rapidly depreciating Confederate currency, rebel soldiers were rendering their own bleak verdict on the war's future course. In early February, Grant obtained a poster showing Lee reduced to begging from local farmers, pleading with them to sell or loan as much cornmeal and molasses as they can spare. Southern conscription covered boys as young as 14 and men as old as 60. Grant believed the Southern people, once ardent to fight, had shed their taste for bloodshed. "Everything looks to me to be very favorable for a speedy termination of the war," he predicted in mid-February, wondering whether rebel leaders would flee or be ousted by their citizens. Inside the Confederate cabinet, Secretary of State Judah Benjamin argued strenuously that blacks must be recruited or Lee would have to abandon Richmond. the Confederate legislature approved a bill to enlist slaves in the army, sidestepping the explosive question of whether to emancipate them. Its most eloquent proponent was Lee, who urgently needed fresh troops. "I think those who are employed as soldiers should be freed," he argued. "It would be neither just nor wise, in my opinion, to require them to serve as slaves." The Charleston Mercury noted the absurdity of the whole enterprise. "Assert the right in the Confederate government to emancipate slaves, and it is stone dead." After the Virginia legislature endorsed the bill for recruiting black soldiers, one or two black companies were assembled and briefly paraded in the Richmond streets, but they came too late to prop up the beleaguered cause. Grant tracked with consuming interest this controversy in Richmond newspapers. Slavery was slowly crumbling, as evidenced by a precipitous drop in the market price for slaves. As the Richmond war clerk John Jones indicated in his diary, "Here the price of slaves, men, is about $5,000 Confederate state notes, or $100 in specie. A great depreciation. Before the war they commanded 10 times that price." All the while, plowing remorselessly through the Deep South, Sherman eradicated supply bases and transportation networks that kept Lee's army alive. By early January, with Savannah secure, Sherman was ready to sally forth again, telling Grant of his plans to carve a path of destruction through Columbia and Camden, South Carolina, followed by Wilmington and Raleigh in North Carolina. "The game is then up with Lee," Sherman stated, "unless he comes out of Richmond, avoids you, and fights me, in which event I should reckon on your being on his heels." His options vanishing, Lee would soon face an unpalatable choice: either stay in Richmond and sacrifice the rest of the South, or head southward, fight in the open, and be squeezed between Sherman's and Grant's converging armies. Lincoln allegedly gave humorous expression to this by saying, "Grant has the bear by the hind leg, while Sherman takes off the hide." Rolling through Georgia, Sherman's army had collected fugitive slaves at every turn. When the question arose of shipping them to City Point, Halleck interceded to stem any such movement. "Our experience is that Negroes brought north during the cold weather from a warm climate are almost useless. Moreover, they suffer very much from cold." Sherman still complained that jubilant blacks flocking to his army hampered its progress. To deal with this surplus population, he devised one of the war's most innovative measures. The federal government had confiscated 400,000 acres of land. In mid-January, Sherman issued Special Field Order No. 15, which set aside the Sea Islands and a large strip of territory along the Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida coasts for settlement by landless black families. They would be offered 40-acre plots in self-governing communities. By June, this remarkable experiment in Reconstruction offered new life to 40,000 former slaves, although the land titles given out had not yet acquired lasting legal power. Sherman was an improbable author for this most progressive order, and later explained that he had done it as a temporary wartime measure at the behest of Stanton. On February 1st, Sherman began his march through the Carolinas, candidly trumpeting his intention to make the inhabitants fear and dread us. True to his words, his campaign would be indelibly engraved in Southern memory, feeding a deep-seated hatred of Yankees. As a precaution, Grant shipped supplies to predetermined spots along the coast in case Sherman needed them, and he promised to reinforce him, if necessary, with 30,000 men. Exactly as Grant had hoped, Lee diverted troops to halt Sherman's progress, critically undermining his defense of Richmond. Like Grant, Sherman thought that Lee, however fine a tactician, was a poor strategist who would play straight into their hands. "If Lee is a soldier of genius," Sherman lectured, "he will seek to transfer his army from Richmond to Raleigh or Columbia. If he is a man simply of detail, he will remain where he is, and his speedy defeat is sure. But I have little fear that he will be able to move. Grant holds him in a vice." Lee's circumscribed vision became a matter of even greater moment when he was elevated to command all Confederate armies in early February 1865. Like Sherman, Grant recognized the psychological value of a Union army streaking through Southern towns hitherto spared a first-hand glimpse of war. Southern newspapers, Grant noted, proclaimed that Sherman's army was nothing better than a mob of men who were frightened out of their wits. As the hard-charging army then passed their way, showing an invincible spirit, the people became disabused and they saw the true state of affairs. Sherman mapped a route through South Carolina, cradle of the rebellion, that would take him to the state capital at Columbia, which he endowed with special strategic worth. "I expect Jefferson Davis will move heaven and earth to catch me," Sherman told Grant. "Richmond is not more vital to his cause than Columbia and the heart of South Carolina." Sherman's 60,000 battle-tested veterans, now tough, wiry, and resilient, had to ford numberless swamps and rivers in all sorts of weather. They stormed ahead with crusading fervor, burning everything of strategic value in their path. Although their rapacity in Georgia can be exaggerated, they directed a special animus against South Carolina for having started the war. Sherman's march formed only one element of Grant's multifaceted plan to end the conflict. The latter announced a new Department of North Carolina, with John Schofield in command, its mission to take Wilmington and Goldsboro and create new supply sources for Sherman. Grant secretly dispatched 28,000 troops to New Bern and the Cape Fear River on the Atlantic coast, with orders to get a railroad there in working shape to speed the movement of Union troops. This would enable Schofield's army to team up with Sherman in case Lee abandoned Richmond and brought the war farther south. On the surface, Grant seemed idle in Virginia when, in reality, he was spinning intricate webs to catch Lee. "I shall necessarily have to take the odium of apparent inactivity, but if it results, as I expect it will, in the discomfiture of Lee's army, I shall be satisfied," Grant notified Stanton. To counter his initiatives, the Confederate government on February 22nd appointed Joseph Johnston to oversee all Confederate forces in the Carolinas. Sherman's push through South Carolina reached a new phase of heightened intensity on February 17th, when his army entered Columbia, the small but charming state capital. Many residents of Charleston and Augusta had mistakenly repaired there as a sanctuary from Sherman's wrath. For vengeful Union troops, the South Carolina capital was a fit place to punish the hotbed of sedition. Grant and Sherman always insisted that the fire that engulfed large sections of Columbia was set by retreating Confederates, describing this as standard practice when Southern armies surrendered towns. Sherman and his staff pitched in to quell the sudden conflagration, but charges also arose that Sherman's soldiers, giving way to a rowdy spirit, spread the flames with cotton dipped in turpentine. By the time Sherman and his entourage left the town on February 23rd, much of it lay in smoking ruins. While Grant defended Sherman's behavior, neither man seemed unduly disturbed by what had happened. In his memoirs, Grant commented dryly that Union troops had helped to save Columbia, but that the example set by the Confederates in burning the village of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, a town which was not garrisoned, would seem to make a defense of the act of firing the seat of government of the state most responsible for the conflict then raging, not imperative. Sounding more like an avenging angel, Sherman insisted that he hadn't ordered the destruction of Columbia, but, "I have never shed any tears over it, because I believe that it hastened what we all fought for, the end of the war." With Columbia gone, Charleston soon succumbed, and the two losses spread fear and lamentation through the South. The scenes that now unfolded heralded not simply impending Confederate defeat, but a brave new biracial world. In a sight scarcely credible to Southern eyes, the black 54th Massachusetts Infantry arrived in Charleston, lustily singing John Brown's Body. The headline in The Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison's abolitionist paper, captured the extraordinary symbolism. Babylon is fallen. Grant felt the war careering toward its climactic scene. Everything looks like dissolution in the South. A few days more of success with Sherman will put us where we can crow loud. A swelling cascade of Union victories ensued, with Wilmington falling to Schofield on February 22nd, shutting down the last major Southern port. A restless Grant never quite knew Sherman's location, but assumed he was hurtling toward Goldsboro and would soon join forces with Schofield. Belatedly, Richmond newspapers awoke to the realization that Grant traced Sherman's mysterious movements through their own columns. The papers are requested to say nothing relative to military operations in South and North Carolina, wrote the rebel war clerk John Jones on February 25th, for they are read by General Grant every morning of their publication. A winter of freezing Virginia temperatures meant that Grant's campaign against Lee was paralyzed by snow and record cold. Heavy rains washed out roads, forcing Grant to wait until they dried. By late February, Grant assigned Sheridan to lead an expedition to wreck the railroads and the James River Canal that supported Lee's army. In sending Sheridan toward Lynchburg, he contemplated that his cavalry would clear the Shenandoah Valley of Confederates, then link up with Sherman as the latter advanced north, eating out the vitals of South Carolina, as Grant phrased it. Sheridan's horsemen rode through a heavy downpour that plastered their uniforms with mud. Sheridan balked at the idea of teaming up with Sherman to defeat Lee, thinking it essential that Eastern soldiers from the Army of the Potomac should share in Lee's defeat. One day, Grant spread out a map for Julia to show her the deployment of his armies and display his grand design. "You observe it is a perfect cordon from sea to sea again," he told her. When she asked what came next, he replied, "Well, I'm going to tighten that cordon until the rebellion is crushed or strangled." Grant had reached his peak powers as a strategist, and Horace Porter noted that his operations now covered a theater of war greater than that of any campaigns in modern history and required a grasp and comprehension which have rarely been possessed even by the greatest commanders. Grant was at this period indefatigable in his labors, and he once wrote in a single day 42 important dispatches with his own hand. In late February, General Ord met with General Longstreet about prisoner exchanges and the problem posed by barter of newspapers, tobacco, and other items between pickets on opposing sides. Before long, their talks touched on the possibility of their commanding generals hashing out a peace settlement. Ord argued that since Northern politicians balked at such talks, only generals could make it happen. The honest Longstreet called it a great crime against the Southern people and army for the chief generals to continue to lead their men to hopeless and unnecessary butchery. The two men discussed a rather fanciful plan in which Longstreet's wife would pass through Union lines with Confederate officers to meet with her cousin and old girlhood friend, Julia Grant, who would reciprocate with a return visit to Richmond with Union officers. Julia, at City Point, seemed wildly excited by this diplomatic gambit. "Oh, how enchanting, how thrilling," she told her husband. "Oh, Ulysses, I may go, may I not?" Grant reined in her enthusiasm. "No, you must not. The men have fought this war, and the men will finish it." Initially, Grant blessed the talks, and on March 2nd, Lee wrote to propose a meeting dealing with the subjects of controversy between the belligerents. Aware he was treading on tenuous ground, Grant submitted the matter to Stanton, who sharply disapproved and informed him that Lincoln wishes you to have no conference with General Lee unless it be for the capitulation of Lee's army. He instructs me to say that you are not to decide, discuss, or confer upon any political question. In response, Grant reassured Stanton he wouldn't venture into politics and would continue to prosecute the war to the utmost of my ability. The secessionist cause lay dying everywhere in the South. All through February, as the social life drained out of Richmond, those who could afford it fled in massive numbers toward outlying areas or safe havens in North Carolina. The Confederate government braced for the capital's surrender, collecting tobacco that could be set ablaze at the entrance of Union troops. With something close to panic, government officials and their families prepared for an evacuation. At the War Office, clerks stockpiled boxes and got ready to pack up the archives and move them away from prying northern eyes. Grant's main fear wasn't that Lee would stand and fight. Rather, he worried that Lee's mobile army would suddenly take flight and dart south to North Carolina or drive west toward Lynchburg and eastern Tennessee, prolonging the war for a year. However passive he might appear, Grant knew his main job was to keep Lee's army cooped up in Richmond and Petersburg until Sherman and Schofield merged their forces in North Carolina. If he applied too much pressure prematurely, the move could backfire, prompting Lee to scuttle south from Richmond and break up the crucial rendezvous of Union forces farther south. Back in Washington, Lincoln signed a flurry of last-minute bills passed by the outgoing Congress, including one to create a Freedmen's Bureau meant to last 1 year and help provision freed slaves with food, clothing, housing, and fuel. To avoid any appearance of favoritism, it was also supposed to assist white refugees in the South. Significantly, it was authorized to extend the sort of program that Sherman had launched along the southern coast to assign 40-acre plots to landless ex-slaves. On March 4, 1865, a wretched, rainy day in the Capitol, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president for his second term. Despite cold gusts that buffeted the Capitol's east portico, 30,000 onlookers showed up, and the London Times estimated that at least half the multitude were colored people. A company of black soldiers, a first for an inauguration, marched in the parade. Standing beneath the Capitol dome, looking especially thin and gaunt, Lincoln delivered an inaugural address rich in biblical imagery that tried to set a forgiving tone for the peace Grant would soon bring about. "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." Perhaps no less consequential for Grant's political future than Lincoln's speech was the boorish behavior of the new vice president, Andrew Johnson of Tennessee. When he took the oath of office in the Senate chamber, he gave a rambling 20-minute speech shot through with populist overtones that left more than one bemused spectator thinking him in a state of manifest intoxication. Allegedly to soothe his nerves because of a recent illness, Johnson had imbibed a few glasses of whiskey before the ceremony, and this showed all too plainly. When Johnson was done, Lincoln whispered to the parade marshal, "Do not let Johnson speak outside." Joining the inaugural festivities was Frederick Douglass, and when Lincoln pointed him out to Johnson, Douglass saw only bitter contempt and aversion for him etched in the vice president's face. The day after the inauguration, Grant received welcome news that Phil Sheridan had not simply defeated Jubal Early near Charlottesville, but had captured his officers, stores, and wagons. The Shenandoah Valley was now stripped bare of Confederate troops and produce for Lee's army. Provided with a clear field to move east toward Richmond, Sheridan's cavalry unleashed a rampage of destruction against the infrastructure supporting Lee, crippling the Virginia Central Railroad and locks, dams, and boats on the James River Canal. "Negroes had joined Sheridan's column to the number of 2,000 or more," recalled Grant, "and they assisted considerably in the work of destroying the railroads and the canal." Grant received news of Sheridan's conquest in an unorthodox manner. During dinner in the officers' mess, a teenage scout was hustled into his presence. He had on a pair of soldier's trousers, 3 or 4 inches too short, and a blouse three sizes too large, recalled Porter. The intelligence he brought was written on tissue paper and enclosed in a ball of tin foil which the scout had carried in his mouth. Grant unwrapped the three-page message and read aloud Sheridan's exuberant description of the dismantling of enemy assets. The catalog of destruction, including canal locks, aqueducts, railroad bridges, warehouses, and factories, was simply staggering. Only two railroads were left to service Lee at Richmond, and Grant now ordered Sheridan to finish up the job. As he felt his army being slowly encircled and squeezed to death, Lee knew he would have to give up Richmond and Petersburg or risk losing his entire army. By mid-March, Grant knew the South's war machine was winding down, its people weary and disillusioned. At some point, Grant assumed, the isolated Lee would fall back to Lynchburg or execute a frantic effort to hook up with Johnston's army in North Carolina. To deal with this contingency, he put his commanders on high alert, ready to move out troops on short notice. In this mood of cool-headed optimism, convinced the rebel army would collapse in a matter of weeks, Grant learned of the death of his oldest sister, Clara Rachel, who had died on March 6th and was the second sibling to pass away during the war. Although I had known for some time that she was in a decline, yet I was not expecting to hear of her death at this time. I have had no heart to write earlier, Grant told his father. With the war fast approaching its denouement, Grant could spare no time for rites of mourning. Union armies scented victory in the air. On March 11th, Sherman took Fayetteville, North Carolina, invading its bountiful arsenal, and his men grew ruddy with conquest. The army is in splendid health, condition, and spirit, he wrote to Grant with characteristic brio. Although we have had foul weather and roads that would have stopped travel to almost any other body of men I ever read of. Huge crowds of ex-slaves gravitated joyously to his banner, while Sherman, who still had a war to fight, continued to regard them as an encumbrance. Grant told Sherman he would consider his army entirely safe once he learned it had joined forces with Schofield's. Speeding across North Carolina at a northeastern diagonal, Sherman's army reached Goldsboro and the long-awaited union with Schofield's on March 23rd. With justice, he hailed his march as one of the longest and most important marches ever made by an organized army in a civilized country. The combined armies of Sherman and Schofield numbered nearly 90,000 men, eclipsing fewer than 20,000 fielded by Joe Johnston. And when those 90,000 men were added to Union forces positioned outside Petersburg and Richmond, Grant oversaw a colossal force of 217,000 well-fed, well-armed soldiers ready to crush Lee and stamp out the rebellion for good. With his second inauguration behind him, Abraham Lincoln underwent a spell of illness and exhaustion, doubtless from the cumulative fatigue of four harrowing years of war. I'm a tired man, he admitted to one visitor. Sometimes I think I'm the tiredest man on earth. By mid-March, unable to rise from bed, he convened a cabinet meeting in his bedroom where he lay braced by pillows. His deeply scored face reflected the hardships he had endured. It looked care-plowed, tempest-tossed, and weather-beaten, Horace Greeley remarked. Julia Grant, noticing frequent newspaper references to Lincoln's run-down appearance, suggested her husband invite him for a visit. By this point, Grant was keenly attuned to the president's moods and agreed that a vacation from Washington would refresh his sagging spirits. From Robert Lincoln, he also knew that the president didn't care to intrude on his chief general and would require a gentle nudge. "Can you not visit City Point for a day or two?" Grant wired Lincoln on March 20th. I would like very much to see you, and I think the rest would do you good. Eager to escape the capital and see his son, Lincoln readily accepted. He was really most anxious to see the army, Grant explained, and be with it in its final struggle. Aboard the sidewheel steamboat River Queen, Lincoln traveled to Virginia with Mary and their youngest son, Tad. As the war approached its end, he reverted to a cheerfulness unseen for many years. During this poignant interlude, Mary Lincoln said the president was almost boyish in his mirth and reminded me of his original nature, what I had always remembered of him in our own home, free from care, surrounded by those he loved so well. On the night of March 24th, the River Queen docked at City Point, and Lincoln's bodyguard, William Crook, remembered the splendid scenery with the many-colored lights of the boats in the harbor and the lights of the town straggling up the high bluffs of the shore, crowned by the lights from Grant's headquarters at the top. Accompanied by Julia and Robert Lincoln, Grant ambled down to the gangplank and welcomed the president, who clasped his hand cordially. The socializing didn't last long, since the Lincolns, spent from their journey, wished to retire to bed. At dawn the next morning, a sad-eyed Robert E. Lee essayed his last offensive battle, sending a large force east of Petersburg to seize a bulwark known as Fort Stedman. More than a last-ditch effort to shatter the siege, it represented the first step in a strategy to blast out an escape route to reinforce Joseph Johnston in North Carolina. Even though his men overran Fort Stedman, they couldn't retain it and fell back before a heavy Union onslaught, losing nearly 5,000 men, with 2,000 taken prisoner. Lee's desperate gamble, Grant knew, meant the war had entered its endgame. Between rebel soldiers slaughtered and captured, Lee had sacrificed a significant fraction of his army when he could ill afford additional losses. Lincoln was scheduled to review troops that morning, and it said much about Grant's confidence in the military situation that he didn't cancel the outing, but merely rescheduled it for the afternoon, not far distant from where the fighting had unfolded. After breakfast, Robert Lincoln briefed his father on Fort Stedman, and the president telegraphed the news to Stanton in oddly jocular tones. "Robert just now tells me there was a little rumpus up the line this morning, ending about where it began." Apparently Lincoln did not fathom the severity of the fighting until he surveyed the blood-stained field where it unfolded. "The ground immediately about us was still strewn with dead and wounded men," a member of the entourage recalled, when a knot of Confederate prisoners marched by. Lincoln remarked upon their sad and unhappy condition, his whole face showing sympathetic feeling for the suffering about him. "By the time Lincoln reviewed the troops," said a Confederate captive, "he had regained his composure, was buoyed by the appreciative soldiers, and appeared seemingly not in the least concerned, and as if nothing had happened." Lincoln toted a map that he consulted frequently, showing his exact knowledge of the positions assumed by Union forces. Always sensitive toward Grant, Lincoln made a point of not pestering him for predictions about the war's conclusion, for which Grant was grateful. "I never would have risked my reputation with Mr. Lincoln by any such prophecies." As they spent considerable time together, Grant came to respect Lincoln as a fine horseman, and allowed him to use his horse Cincinnati, an excellent trotter, riding with him on swampy roads to far-flung camps. Lincoln's presence lifted the spirit of Union troops, who warmly received him, and he reciprocated with kindly words and gracious salutes. When he met soldiers chopping wood for a cabin, the old rail splitter, wielding an axe, sliced open a hefty piece of timber to enthusiastic cheers from the men. One day, Lincoln devoted 5 hours to patients at an army field hospital, and in a tender spirit of reconciliation, shook hands with wounded Confederates. Even the most patronizing officers fell under his spell. Colonel Theodore Lyman described Lincoln as "the ugliest man I ever put my eyes on," with an expression of plebeian vulgarity in his face. Nonetheless, his brief conversation with Lincoln satisfied him that he was a very honest and kindly man who resembled a highly intellectual and benevolent satyr. At night, Lincoln reveled in the camaraderie of the campfire and luxuriated in this respite from the pressures of the executive mansion. There were no office seekers to pursue him, no legislators to lobby him, no reporters to hound him. Despite his proximity to battlefield perils, he was surprisingly relaxed, and Porter observed that as Lincoln sat in a camp chair with his long legs doubled up in grotesque attitudes and the smoke of the fire curling around him, he looked the picture of comfort and good nature. With inexhaustible good humor, he traded quips and stories and reminisced about the war. When someone asked if he had ever doubted the North's final victory, he shot back, "Never for a moment." He quoted Seward, saying that there was always just enough virtue in this republic to save it, sometimes none to spare, but still enough to meet the emergency. And he agreed with Mr. Seward in this view. Grant derived special pleasure from Lincoln's expansive fireside mood. As he later said, the president talked and talked and talked, and the old man seemed to enjoy it, and said, "How grateful I feel to be with the boys and see what is being done at Richmond." He would sit for hours, tilted back in his chair, with his hand shading his eyes, watching the movements of the men with the greatest interest. By this point, the Lincoln-Grant relationship had ripened into genuine friendship. Both men had been caricatured as simpletons from the western prairies and greeted with contemptuous sneers by detractors. A certain self-deprecating modesty deceived people into underrating both of them, causing them to miss an underlying shrewdness. Grant always treated Lincoln with tremendous love and reverence. Unlike some earlier generals, Grant had been completely honorable in his dealings with him, never bad-mouthing him behind his back. "He was a great man, a very great man," was his final verdict. "The more I saw of him, the more this impressed me. He was incontestably the greatest man I ever knew." He rejected the idea that Seward or Chase or Stanton governed Lincoln's decisions. It was that gentle firmness in carrying out his own will without apparent force or friction that formed the basis of his character. He was especially taken with Lincoln's quick, intuitive mind. Long before the statement of a complicated question is finished, his mind will grasp the main points, and he will seem to comprehend the whole subject better than the person who is stating it. Relations between the Grants and the volatile Mary Lincoln were unfortunately strained. With her round, open face, Mary was as short and plump as her husband was tall and thin. When his train whistle-stopped to Washington for his first inauguration, Lincoln would materialize on the platform, the compact Mary at his side, and joke to the crowd that now they could see the long and short of it. The daughter of a Lexington, Kentucky banker, Mary had grown up in surroundings not dissimilar from Julia Grant's comfortable St. Louis home. She had slaves at her beck and call and was well-educated at fine private schools where she learned French. This sociable woman aspired to mingle in tonier society than her husband, who put on no airs and had the common touch. Even in the early days with Lincoln, an imperious streak marred Mary's witty, vivacious manner. "This woman was to me a terror," said Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, who perhaps unfairly labeled her imperious, proud, aristocratic, insolent, witty, and bitter. The spendthrift Mary struggled with the frugality imposed by Lincoln's comparatively lean years as a lawyer. From their earliest days of marriage, she exhibited a sharp tongue and fiery temper that made household help and even her husband wary of her stormier moods. Yet despite flashes of acrimony and troubling undercurrents, the marriage was marked by deep mutual devotion and loyalty, and Mary Lincoln greatly assisted her husband's rise in the world. The role of president's wife suited her ambitions, and she proved a convivial hostess at gatherings. Still, she managed to alienate some people with her pretensions as she lavishly refurbished the executive mansion. One newspaper editor mocked her as the laughing stock of the town, her vulgarity only the more conspicuous in consequence of her fine carriage and horses and servants in livery and fine dresses and her damnable airs. Lincoln's secretary, John Nicolay, dreaded her unruly temper, christening her Her Satanic Majesty. Mary Lincoln grew deeply envious of Kate Chase, the beautiful young daughter of the Treasury Secretary, and insisted on striking her name, along with those of her husband and father, from the list of a cabinet dinner in January 1864. When Lincoln vetoed this action, Nicolay said, there soon arose such a rampage as the House hasn't seen for a year. Four of Mary's five Kentucky brothers fought with the Confederates, which did not endear her to the Northern public, feeding scurrilous commentary about treason in the White House. That one brother died at Shiloh and the other at Vicksburg may have unconsciously contributed to her pronounced dislike of Grant. Elizabeth Keckley, the black seamstress who worked for Mary, recorded her invective against him. "He is a butcher," she would often say, "and is not fit to be at the head of an army." When Lincoln rebutted her, citing Grant's victories, Mary insisted that he loses two men to the enemy's one. He has no management, no regard for life. Lincoln, who disliked confrontation, sought to mollify her with a mixture of mild humor and forgiving tolerance. "Well, mother, supposing that we give you command of the army, no doubt you would do much better than any general that has been tried." In 1864, Adam Badeau was amazed to learn from Mrs. Stanton that she had stopped seeing Mary Lincoln altogether. "That was not possible," Badeau responded. "I do not go to the White House," she repeated. "I do not visit Mrs. Lincoln." Mary's fragile mental health was damaged in 1850 when her three-year-old son, Eddie, died. Even though she had two more boys, Willie and Tad, in addition to Robert, she never quite recuperated from the loss. Her behavior grew more erratic in February 1862 when Willie, age 11, died from typhoid fever, contracted by drinking polluted water from White House faucets. For 3 weeks, Mary languished in bed and was unable to attend the funeral. So potent was her grief that she never again set foot in the bedroom where Willie died, or in the green room where his corpse lay embalmed. Seeking comfort from spiritualists who conducted up to 8 seances in the White House, Mary came to believe she could commune with her two dead sons and drifted into a dream world of fantasied reunions. "Willie lives," she told a relative. "He comes to me every night and stands at the foot of the bed with the same sweet, adorable smile he always has had. Little Eddie is sometimes with him." For almost a year, subdued by mourning, the Lincolns mostly stopped entertaining while Mary distracted herself shopping for clothing and jewelry in New York and Philadelphia, running up unpaid bills. During the City Point stay in late March 1865, Mary Lincoln's behavior seemed to regress from the bizarre to the almost pathological. When Julia paid a courtesy call on her, she was coldly received. As she sat down on the sofa next to Mary, the latter shot her a look of protest as if she were guilty of lèse majesté. Julia sprang to her feet. "I crowd you, I fear," she said quickly. "Not at all," Mary replied, encouraging Julia to sit down. Julia took a chair instead, not daring to risk Mary's wrath again. The Dent family grapevine kept the story alive. Emma Dent Casey, Julia's sister, often told the story that Julia was outraged because Mrs. Lincoln had expected her to back out of the room and to treat her like royalty, wrote an early biographer of Julia Grant. In any event, there were cool relations between the two women from the start. Grant invited the Lincolns to travel to the north side of the James River and review the Army of the James under General Ord. The latter was one of Grant's favorites, a twice-wounded West Point veteran whom he appreciated as skillful in the management of troops, brave and prompt. To reach the parade ground at Malvern Hill, Grant rode on horseback with a high-spirited Lincoln, General Ord, and the general's pretty young wife, Mary. Mary Lincoln and Julia Grant lagged behind in an ambulance, accompanied on this bumpy ride by Badeau and Horace Porter. At one point on the uneven road, the half-open carriage struck a deep rut that threw the ladies violently against the top, smashing their heads and bonnets. The incident rattled the high-strung Mary, who had suffered a serious carriage accident in 1863, and it may have triggered a migraine headache as well. During the ride, Mary discovered that Mrs. Ord had ridden ahead with her husband and flew into a jealous rage. "What does the woman mean by riding by the side of the president and ahead of me? Does she suppose that he wants her by the side of him?" When Julia Grant tried to settle her down, Mary turned her wrath on Julia. "I suppose you think you'll get to the White House yourself, don't you?" Mary Lincoln was watchful, even paranoid, about potential rivals to her husband, and had resented newspaper references to Grant as a possible presidential nominee the year before. Maintaining her dignity, Julia replied that she was quite satisfied with her present position, but Mary refused to relent. "Oh, you had better take it if you can get it. 'Tis very nice," she said, and went back to maligning Mrs. Ord. At Malvern Hill, Mary was enraged that the review had started in her absence. The troops had awaited Lincoln's arrival for hours. With her husband trotting down the line beside the fetching Mrs. Ord, who wore a plumed hat. As the band played, Grant's horse pranced and reared its head, while Lincoln, in top hat and black frock coat, rode his mount with stately calm. When Mrs. Ord, at Julia's behest, galloped over to greet Mary, the First Lady lashed out at her in a vituperative outburst. Mrs. Lincoln positively insulted her, called her vile names in the presence of a crowd of officers, and asked what she meant by following up the president, wrote Badeau. The poor woman burst into tears and inquired what she had done, but Mrs. Lincoln refused to be appeased and stormed till she was tired. To no avail, Julia gallantly tried to defend Mrs. Ord. That night, the Lincolns entertained the Grants aboard the River Queen, when Mary again erupted in a tantrum and berated General Ord to the president and urged that he should be removed, Badeau continued. He was unfit for his place, she said, to say nothing of his wife. General Grant sat next and defended his officer bravely. Mary accused her husband of flirting brazenly with Mrs. Ord. Though Lincoln tried to deflect these attacks, Mary would not desist. Throughout the City Point visit, Badeau claimed, Mary Lincoln kept attacking her husband in front of other officers. "He bore it as Christ might have done, with an expression of pain and sadness that cut one to the heart, but with supreme calmness and dignity." The embarrassed president would hang his head, call his wife mother, attempt to soothe her, then stroll away when all else failed. For the remainder of her visit, Mary Lincoln mostly stayed incommunicado in her cabin before returning to Washington on April 1st, leaving her husband and Tad behind. In her memoirs, it should be noted, Julia Grant criticized Adam Badeau for having embellished the story of her contretemps with Mary Lincoln. On March 27th, William Tecumseh Sherman, who hadn't set eyes on Grant for a year, arrived at City Point for an overnight visit devoted to strategy sessions with Grant, Admiral Porter, and Lincoln. Sherman, having consummated his long-sought juncture with General Schofield at Goldsboro, was ready to launch the next stage of war. In fine fettle, he jested that he wanted to see Grant and stir him up, out of fear that the long Petersburg stalemate had fossilized him. With typical zest, he said, "I'm going up to see Grant for 5 minutes and have it all chalked out for me, and then come back and pitch in." When Sherman arrived aboard the steamer Russia, Grant hurried to the wharf to embrace his foremost colleague. According to Horace Porter, the hyperactive Sherman didn't simply step ashore, but jumped ashore and was hurrying forward with long strides to meet his chief. Such was the bonhomie of Grant and Sherman as they shook hands, that they reminded Porter of two schoolboys fondly reunited after summer vacation. For an hour, as Grant enjoyed a cigar by the campfire, Sherman entertained his staff with tales of his march to the sea and through the Carolinas before Grant decided it was time to pay court to the president. "I know he will be anxious to see you," Grant assured him. "Suppose we go and pay him a visit before supper." Based on an encounter earlier in the war, the headstrong Sherman wasn't prepared to like Lincoln, but he was now utterly beguiled as they chatted aboard the River Queen. The president wasn't the simple rube he had imagined, so much as a man of feeling, wisdom, and sincerity. Sherman noted how the careworn Lincoln came alive when he spoke, his face growing animated, his long, slack arms flying into motion. "Of all the men I ever met," he concluded, "Lincoln seemed to possess more of the elements of greatness combined with goodness than any other." Insatiably curious about the historic march, Lincoln listened raptly to Sherman's sparkling rendition. According to Sherman, the president seemed to enjoy very much the more ludicrous parts about the bummers and their devices to collect food and forage when the outside world supposed us to be starving. Overshadowed by the talkative Sherman, Grant was content to sit back and say relatively little during two meetings with Lincoln. The first meeting lasted an hour, when Grant and Sherman returned to Julia Grant, who had readied tea for them. She asked if they had seen Mrs. Lincoln. Grant confessed they had not asked for her. "Well, you are a pretty pair," she chided them. "I do not see how you could have been so neglectful." The two men, conceding their faux pas, pledged to ask after her the next day. It speaks well of Julia Grant that, despite her treatment by Mary Lincoln, she still observed the social amenities and remained concerned about her mental state. When Grant duly inquired after Mrs. Lincoln the next day, the president bore the message to her stateroom and returned to say she was indisposed and begged the gentleman to excuse her. At the second session, the military men got down to business with Lincoln. Grant described how Sheridan was crossing the James River by a pontoon bridge with plans to shatter the South Side and Danville railroads that propped up Lee's army. If Lee responded by striking out for North Carolina, Lincoln feared he might escape by Southern railroads. Sherman insisted his men had destroyed their tracks beyond redemption. "What is to prevent their laying the rails again?" Grant probed. "Why, my bummers don't do things by halves," Sherman explained. "Every rail, after having been placed over a hot fire, has been twisted as crooked as a ram's horn, and they never can be used again." Sherman insisted he could defeat the joint forces of Lee and Johnston if Grant came up behind them in a day or so. On the other hand, if Lee mistakenly clung to his Richmond defenses, Sherman would roar up from North Carolina, and he and Grant would starve out Lee or drub him in open combat. Whatever happened, Grant and Sherman saw an inescapably bloody battle ahead, and Lincoln reacted with anguish. "Must more blood be shed?" he cried. "Cannot this last bloody battle be avoided?" On this, the generals could promise nothing. As they pondered post-war reconciliation, Lincoln preached leniency toward the South, saying he didn't want reprisals. Facetiously, he added that he didn't want to hang Confederates so much as hang on to them. Though he couldn't say so publicly, he hinted he would be happy if Jefferson Davis fled the country, avoiding a treason trial that might inflame sectional tensions. "I want no one punished. Treat them liberally all round," Lincoln advised. "We want those people to return to their allegiance to the Union and submit to the laws." While the pacific spirit of his post-war policy seemed clear, the specifics were maddeningly vague, as befit a president still bent on winning the war. Grant came away believing that in dealing with Lee's army, he should be magnanimous in his terms of surrender. "Let them have their horses to plow with, and, if you like, their guns to shoot crows with," Lincoln stated. Sherman came away with a sense of a broad mandate that extended to more political matters, remembering Lincoln's belief that To avoid anarchy, the state governments then in existence, with their civil functionaries, would be recognized by him as the government de facto till Congress could provide others. Sherman soon had reason to cling to this recollection. The afternoon session lasted 3 hours, at the end of which Lincoln, Sherman, and Grant, having been cooped up all afternoon, rambled by the riverside. A reporter captured the vivid contrasts presented by the three men. Lincoln, tall, round-shouldered, loose-jointed, large-featured, deep-eyed, with a smile upon his face, is dressed in black and wears a fashionable silk hat. Grant is at Lincoln's right, shorter, stouter, more compact, wears a military hat with a stiff, broad brim, has his hands in his pantaloon pockets, and is puffing away at a cigar. Sherman, tall, with a high, commanding forehead, is almost as loosely built as Lincoln, has sandy whiskers, closely cropped, and sharp, twinkling eyes, long arms and legs, shabby coat, slouched hat, his pantaloons tucked into his boots. As they strolled, Lincoln suddenly presented an odd question. "Sherman, do you know why I took a shine to Grant and you?" Abashed, Sherman replied, "I don't know, Mr. Lincoln. You have been extremely kind to me, far more than my deserts." "Well, you never found fault with me." Lincoln had been betrayed by so many generals, he was endlessly grateful for the loyalty of Grant and Sherman. It was the last time William Tecumseh Sherman ever set eyes on Lincoln. On the morning of March 29th, in a farewell imbued with poignant emotion, Lincoln returned to Washington. For Julia Grant, it amounted to a double farewell, since her husband was switching headquarters to Gravelly Run for the opening of the Appomattox campaign, which he would personally direct. Horace Porter recounted how Grant bade an affectionate goodbye to Mrs. Grant, kissing her repeatedly as she stood at the front door of his quarters. She bore the parting bravely, although her pale face and sorrowful look told of the sadness that was in her heart. When Grant and his staff escorted Lincoln to the train station, the president's mood turned grave. Porter thought the lines were more deeply incised in his face, the rings darker beneath his eyes. Lincoln gave each officer an affectionate handshake. As his train began to move, Grant and his officers lifted their hats in unison in a gesture of profound respect, and Lincoln repaid them with a salute. "Goodbye, gentlemen," he said, his voice cracking with emotion. "God bless you all. Remember, your success is my success."